It's TechBiter Worldwide with Bill Blinn. The latest on programs and policies, helpful hints, and a bit of occasional nonsense. All in more or less plain English.
Podcast number 873 for the 15th of March, 2024. This week, when a charge for a service I didn't recognize showed up in an alert from my bank, I found that I had been signed up for a video streaming service I'd never heard of. Eliminating the service was easy enough, but a lot of people have reported terminating it was difficult. In short circuits, even those of us who are not typographers, graphic designers, or publishers sometimes need to deal with typefaces. What most people think of as fonts aren't really fonts. And this may be a surprise. It doesn't really matter. Anyone who relies on Amazon's ratings to make buying decisions isn't getting the full story. A service that rates the ratings helps, but it's still wise to proceed with caution. It's easy to get suckered into signing up for a service that has monthly charges. $50 here, $50 there, your bank account is depleted, and you're not quite sure what happened. I encountered one of these fraudulent services recently, but I dodged the bullet. I can't say with absolute certainty that I never signed up for the Froost.com 5-day trial, but I don't recall signing up for it, and the service offers things that don't really interest me. Here's a quote from the site. Explore movies, games, music, and more all in one place. Movies, music, audiobooks, games, software, sports, and concerts. Pick and play whatever you want. Well, I subscribe to several streaming services that have the programs I want. Movies, music, and audiobooks, well, those are provided largely by the library. I license the software I need, and I'm not interested in sports. And besides that, an online service can't really provide access to concerts. So I'm fairly sure that I never signed up for the $50 a month service, not even for the 5-day free trial. But a $50 charge was attempted to my Chase Visa card. Chase sent me a message asking that I confirm that you made this purchase. The charge had been made via 2megagat.co, which I didn't recognize. So I opened a chat session with the billing organization and asked about the charge, which I found out had already been declined by the bank. No harm, no foul, right? Well, no. The no harm part can be put down mainly to Chase Bank's vigilance. Had the charge been successful, it seems that I would have been stuck and had a lot more trouble canceling the service. I found a lot of complaints by people who had accidentally subscribed and couldn't seem to unsubscribe. So I looked a little further. Every Scam Watcher website I checked had bad news about Froost. Every single one. Is Legit Checker says, and I quote, "One of the most alarming aspects of Froost.com is its involvement in a subscription scam. Users have reported difficulties in canceling their subscriptions, trapping them in recurring charges against their will. Despite promises of free movie access, Froost.com creates a web of complexity, making it virtually impossible for users to sever their ties and escape the recurring charges unscathed." Not very positive review, huh? Malware Tips says Froost purchases ads deceptively blended into search results for popular apps. The ads appear alongside legitimate promotions, tricking users into clicking through to the hidden Froost subscription signups. There, they are prompted to enter an email address and credit card information to begin a 5-day free trial. The submission page, says Malware Tips, makes no clear mention of the recurring charges. That actually has changed. The Froost website has added in small but completely legible type, 5 days free, then starting from $49.95 a month. The words starting from made me nervous, indicating that there are higher prices out there, possibly considerably higher. Trustpilot offers reviews from actual users, and although the service has only 64 reviews, 63 of them are one-star reviews. And the 64th review, 2 stars. One reviewer on Reddit described what sounded like my experience. I never even signed up for anything and was charged $49.95. I don't even know what Frust is. So as for me, I know that when I give any organization a credit card number for a free trial offer, I make a note about when the free trial will end, just in case I want to cancel it. It's unclear how Frust obtained my credit card number, but it no longer matters because I reported the scam to the bank and received a replacement card with a new number. And there were lots of additional similar accounts on Reddit. Had I thought about signing up for the service, I first would have checked the company out with a search containing the name of the company and the word fraud. Whether you use Google or DuckDuckGo to perform such a search, the results would be immediately clear that Frust.com is a company to avoid. It's easy to check out companies to avoid becoming entangled in most scams. The only exceptions are when the scammer somehow gets its hands on a valid credit card number and uses it. And had I actually signed up for the service, I would have added login information to my password manager. There was no entry in my password manager for Frust.com. So I have to agree with the reviews and say the site probably isn't exactly an honest business. If you find these podcasts useful, and I hope you do, might you consider a donation? There are no ads here, and support from listeners is the sole source of income. It's easy. Just visit the website and click the donate button near the top of any page. You can make a one-time donation or schedule a repeating donation every month. I thank you. And so does the cat. In short circuits, Google makes a lot of what they call fonts available for anyone to use. How many? Well, Google claimed 1,601 fonts when I prepared this report, but Google actually offers at least 1,601 billion fonts. More accurately, it's an infinite number of fonts. That's because a font probably isn't what you think it is. We can thank Steve Jobs, among others, for the confusion, and I'll come back to that in just a bit. If you're old enough, you may remember that computers didn't have typeface options in the beginning. Line printers that were used on mainframe computers didn't even offer lowercase letters. Then dot matrix printers came along. They could create different types of letter forms. The earliest $3,500 laser printer didn't even offer more than just courier, unless you laid out several hundred additional dollars for a cartridge that offered a few additional typefaces. Then Adobe happened, and nothing has been the same since then. So why are what you may think of as fonts really not fonts? When Apple made multiple typefaces an option for Mac users, Steve Jobs decided to call them fonts. Designers, publishers, and typographers fought against that for a while, but after all, that was 40 years ago. It's just one of those distinctions that got lost along the way. What most people think of as a font is really a typeface. Eurostyle is a typeface, and you can view it on Adobe Fonts. There's a link to Adobe Fonts, although you may need a subscription to do that. You'll see a screenshot on the TechBiter Worldwide website. Eurostyle Regular 12-point is one font. Eurostyle Regular 14-point is another font. And Eurostyle Bold Oblique 12-point is yet a third font. A font includes additional information about the presentation of the typeface, such as size, weight, width, and italics. Maybe one reason the distinction has blurred is the ability to resize type on the fly with a computer. In hot metal type times, the printer would need 3 sets of type for the 3 Eurostyle faces I mentioned. Now, you need to install only the various Eurostyle variants, and you can resize them as needed. If you need a more detailed and entertaining look of typefaces, see Cam Walker's half-hour YouTube program. I have a link to it on the TechBiter Worldwide website. You'll probably smile. You might even laugh, perhaps even guffaw. Guffaw. There's a word you don't hear very often. Anyway, Google Fonts has typefaces in 27 languages. If you're looking for letters used in English and other Western languages, be sure to select either Latin or Latin Extended. You won't find English in the list. Then you can choose some special typeface technologies if you wish. Variable or color. Decorative stroke, which means serif, sans serif, or slab serif. Classification, which would be display, handwriting, monospace, or noto symbols. And limit the number of typefaces shown to only those with a certain number of variants, if you wish. So here's a question. If you have a choice of 1,600 typefaces and an infinite number of fonts, what is the best one for your document? That's a question with a very easy answer. Two, actually, and they are diametrically opposed, and they are both accurate. Answer number one, there is no best font. Answer number two, any font can be the best one. Perhaps you've heard of Comic Sans. It's a typeface that type snobs love to hate, but there are times when it is exactly the right face to use. Vincent Conair invented Comic Sans in 1994 because he was looking for something that was light and fun. Comic Sans is exactly that. So Comic Sans would be the exactly wrong typeface for an annual report by a large corporation, unless perhaps that corporation produced comic books, or in today's terminology, graphic novels. As Vincent Conair said about his Comic Sans typeface, if you love it, you don't know much about typography. If you hate it, you really don't know much about typography either. The same can be said about any typeface. Love it if it's right for the job, hate it if it's not. There's no shortage of hate for Souvenir, even Times New Roman, and for Papyrus, but each of those typefaces and every other typeface has an appropriate use. I had the good fortune to spend some time learning from Jan White. Over his 40-plus years as a designer and typographer, he wrote 12 books on grids, page layout, typography, designing charts and graphs, the use of color, and other aspects of information design. I have several of those books at home. White's guiding principle was that good typography is invisible. If somebody comments on a typeface you've used, well, then your typography has failed. White arranged to have several of his books released as PDF documents in the public domain following his death a decade ago. Design professionals may already have these books, but not everyone who must work with type and design is a professional. White's books can help anyone create documents and publications that may not win design prizes, but will also not be ugly or unreadable. If you'd like more information, see the Jan White Memorial website, and you can download the books from there. Typography, typefaces, and fonts can be a lot of fun, even if you don't know what you're doing. Do you trust Amazon's ratings and reviews? To borrow a few words from Star Trek's Mr. Spock, that would be illogical. Some of the reviews are accurate, but even when you've eliminated the fake reviews, they might not really be all that helpful. Let's start with getting rid of the fake reviews. ReviewMeta uses AI to examine reviews of a product you might be interested in buying and attempts to remove the fakes. But ReviewMeta admits that its analysis may be flawed. Before using the site, you have to agree to these terms, as well as the site's longer terms of service and privacy policy. Here are the basic terms you need to agree to. ReviewMeta is a metrics tool for evaluating Amazon reviews. We are in no way affiliated with or responsible for any products bought on Amazon. We only provide an analysis of user reviews. Our estimate is based on deep data analysis. Pass, fail, warn does not necessarily prove the presence or absence of fake reviews. So let's say you're interested in buying an Amazon Kindle Fire 11 tablet with 256 gigabytes of memory and no ads on the lock screen. Well, there are 3,450 ratings with an average rating of 4.4 out of 5. ReviewMeta eliminates 1,207 reviews as being unreliable, but the resulting average rating is still 4.4. The system considers whether reviewers are verified purchasers of the item, whether the reviewer has a history of having their reviews deleted, whether reviews have been paid for or otherwise influenced by the provider, and more. If you'd search for a Samsung 32-inch class LED smart full high-definition TV, well, you'd find 1,788 reviews. ReviewMeta considers nearly 1,100 of them to be suspicious. The result of removing those reviews doesn't change the overall rating, though. So this might be a useful tool when shopping on Amazon, but it still doesn't resolve the overarching concerns about Amazon reviews in general. Amazon reviews can be a valuable resource, and I generally look at them when I'm considering a purchase. The reviews serve as a single data point, but they are insufficient in helping to guide intelligent buying decisions. It's reasonably well known that Amazon's product pages often have many deceptive reviews because unethical companies can manipulate the ratings, and they can do that pretty easily. They may offer discounts for positive reviews or even payments to reviewers. After all, more positive reviews means the product will be more visible on Amazon. Seeing verified purchase on a review means that Amazon believes the reviewer has bought the product, but some companies anonymously send free products to random individuals hoping to get positive reviews. This, of course, doesn't work for high-cost or low-margin products, but it has proven effective for fraudulent products that are acquired at a low cost and sold at a huge profit. Fake reviews seem to be all too common. An article in the Chicago Tribune claims its research shows 42% of reviews it examined were bogus. Amazon does investigate suspicious reviews, but the volume of reviews makes it all but impossible to catch more than the worst offenders. Tom's Guide says that Amazon encourages customers to report suspicious reviews and that the company will suspend, ban, or even pursue legal action against bad actors. But again, they're only going to get the worst of the worst. In Buyer Beware, Amazon's questionable product ratings, a long and technically complex article by the New York City Data Science Academy, writer Will Freeman says Amazon ratings cannot be trusted. He notes that it's difficult to develop a definitive policy. A more specific question is whether Amazon reviews reliably and accurately differentiate better products from worse products. Obviously, there is no available correct average rating for each product, but there are more reliable and objective sources of product reviews. There's also the question of consistency. If reviews are inconsistent across a large set of reviewers over time or from one e-commerce platform to the next, that would suggest they are not sensible or trustworthy. The full article from the New York City Data Science Academy is most interesting, and I think it'd be worth your time. There's a link to it on the TechBiter Worldwide website. So when you're thinking about making a purchase, check more than just Amazon. Ask your preferred search engine to provide reviews. See what an organization such as Consumer Reports has to say about the product or the manufacturer. And check with the Better Business Bureau to find if there are active complaints. Let the buyer beware has never been more important than it is today. Or, as they said back in Caesar's day, caveat emptor. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn. There's more on the website, techbiter.com, and if you have a question or a comment, use the contact link you'll find there. Stop by again next week for another session.